I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Welcome to the Fried Egg Golf Podcast. I'm Garrett Morrison, and today we're digging into the story behind one of the most buzzed about new golf courses in America. I'm talking about Old Barnwell near Aiken, South Carolina. This Brian Schneider and Blake Conant design has received rave reviews since opening for preview play last year. I got to play it on the Sunday before the Masters, and I can confirm that it is an incredibly inventive work of golf architecture and just a fun course to play. But another thing that makes Old Barnwell stand out in the current crop of new private golf clubs, and there are a lot of them, is its vision for itself. This is a club that wants to have a positive impact on the world, and in this episode, we'll talk about how feasible it is to have that kind of impact with a golf club. I realize that this idea of a mission-focused club might provoke some skepticism, so we'll address that. My guest is Nick Schreiber. Nick is the founder of Old Barnwell, and this is really his passion project. He's there all the time. He was there the day that I played it. This is really his baby. So I'm looking forward to digging into the nitty-gritty of how he got this thing built and what he hopes it'll become. First, though, let's talk a little bit about Good Walk Coffee. I was super excited to hear that we were partnering with Good Walk. This is a company that I've admired from afar ever since they launched in 2019. And it's really a company that sits right at the nexus of my two big interests, coffee and golf. Good Walk was founded by coffee nuts who also happen to be golf nuts. And they're very serious about applying the golf values of fair play and honesty to the way that they conduct their coffee business. They buy high-grade beans from around the world at fair market prices from farmers who follow sustainable practices and pay good living wages to their workers. And importantly, these beans happen to be very, very good. Specifically, the Fried Egg Golf blend is delicious. That's right, we have our own blend with Good Walk. It's a bright and vibrant organic coffee roasted to a medium-light level. It has beans from Central and South America blended with a naturally processed coffee from Ethiopia to create a balance of milk chocolate and berry flavors. It's what I've been drinking recently. Absolutely love it. So go to goodwalkcoffee.com/friedegg and use the code friedegg at checkout to save 20% on your entire order. Or you can use the same code to start a coffee subscription. That will save you 30% on your first order, and then you'll save 10% on all future shipments. You can pause, skip, or cancel your subscription at any time on the website. So again, goodwalkcoffee.com/friedegg. Check it out. All right, so I'm here with Nick Schreiber. Nick, how did the first Masters week at Old Barnwell go? That's a big deal for clubs in the Aiken, South Carolina area.
You know, for not having a clubhouse, a lodge, or really a team of more than five or six folks, I think we acquitted ourselves quite well. I hope our guests felt that way. I think like other, you know, clubs in the area, you know, we open it up to the public and we charge an arm and a leg. I think we have the advantage that, you know, basically the money we make during that week or 8 days basically helps fund our mission programming. And so, you know, we were able to, we didn't hit halfway, but we got very close to hitting half of our mission programming budget for the next 12 months. So we were very lucky. We were grateful to have all the guests coming out there. And I will say that like, there's like mini golf celebrities. It's really fun to see like, you know, like a Bob Ford or something like that, that like only 0.0001% of the population would have any, you know, would care about it all, but it was fun. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, you should try to get as many people out there who are on those old trading cards as possible. Yes. I feel like that would be, and put the cards up in the clubhouse. That would be great. My understanding is that you got your start in golf by being a caddy.
Mm-hmm. I think caddying is the best job I've ever had. You know, as a 13, 14 year old, to walk away with, at the time, I think I was making $35 a loop in cash, plus like a candy bar and a soda, was, you know, you felt like you were robbing a bank. And to do it outside and, you know, to meet the people that you get to meet. And so for me, caddying is still such a central part of how I understand the game of golf. And I mean, I look back at those times quite fondly, and the courses that I got to caddy at north of Chicago were pretty fantastic, though I didn't fully appreciate it at the time, because you're a little focused on just not dropping somebody's clubs or, you know, making mistakes.
How did you get into it in the first place?
So in my family, I'm one of eight kids, and in our family, you know, my father did not grow up with much. And so he and my parents have been very successful together, but it didn't matter. You know, in our family, it was like, when you turn 13, you get a summer job. And so I washed dishes and at a local restaurant and caddy. And that was just the easiest. There was very little application. You know, I didn't have to interview. You basically show up for training and they kind of let you go out. And after that first summer, I was at Old Elm, basically, you know, which was a 15-minute, 20-minute bike ride from where I grew up. So I would go there, you know, basically every weekend, and during the summer would be able to get loops, you know, pretty much every day of the week. And so it was just a very easy transition into never having worked before into having a job.
So let's fast forward a little bit. What led you down the path of becoming the founder of a golf club? You're not a career long golf industry type. And so what got you to this point?
Yeah, no, I have no business doing this. And I think that my awareness around that has served us quite well, I think, because it means that we really focus on getting people who do know what they're doing. But basically, it does kind of start with that caddy mentality and the opportunity that it gave me and, you know, my colleagues. I don't know if you can call fellow caddies your colleagues. It sounds a little too fancy. But basically, that always stuck with me. I fell in love with the game of golf after that. My father did not play. And so at that point, my brother and I started to convince him to play. And though I was never a great golfer, by the time that I was in my professional career, golf had done something very similar to what it had done for me when I was a caddy. I was meeting people that benefited worked at a software company and I ran sales. And so you're starting to meet clients or potential partners. And eventually, the private equity group that purchased us, you know, some of those relationships were honed on the golf course. And so that just always stuck in my mind as something that this is a game that we all love, but it's way more powerful than people, I think, give it credit. And so, you know, how I got into this, I mentioned this earlier, and I think it's really important to acknowledge. So my parents have been remarkably successful. And so when we sold our business, I've told this story. I don't love telling this part of the story, but basically, I was the last kind of co-founding executive standing at the company when we sold it. And I stuck around for the transition. They merged us with a portfolio company of theirs. And then I actually went to treatment. So I had a substance abuse problem and a drinking problem that I'd hid pretty effectively for a long time. And so I actually went away and I had to get myself right. And as you can imagine, this is not a fun thing to talk about, particularly when I had an 11-month-old at the time. And you know, you turn your life upside down. But when I got back and I'm, you know, uncertain about what's going to happen really in every category of my life, I was in this really unique and fortunate position. One, to have a spouse, my wife, Sarah, who encouraged me to consider what it was that I wanted to do to make, you know, that I would be happy, you know, and passionate about doing. Because as much as I love starting a business, we were in HR tech. I don't love performance reviews or, you know, employee engagement surveys, right? And so that kind of led me to consider something along those lines. And then, yes, like my kids, I have two boys now. They are taken care of because of the success that my parents have had. There's no other way to say it. And so it allowed my wife and I to really think about, well, we're in this unique and fortunate position financially to do something as crazy as starting a golf club. And so that's really the genesis behind just the conversation starting between Sarah and myself.
You've described Old Barnwell before as a mission-focused club. So what is the mission here, and why is that so critical to you?
Sure. Well, I'll take a step back and kind of say that in the beginning, you know, when I kind of brought up these ideas to Sarah, I didn't know if it'd be a golf club. I mean, we talked about doing a par three course, something public, something private. Like, there were so many different options on the table. And I think that at the heart of all those, you know, options was this idea of doing something that would make an impact on the community, as cliche as that sounds. And so as we kind of refine the ideas around it, you know, I'll go back to my caddying experience, and then the experience that as I got older and, you know, having the opportunity to play some of, you know, not a ton, but some of the best clubs or, you know, private courses in the country, you know, you realize that all great private clubs have two things at their disposal that they can use to impact their community in a positive way. And the first is the golf course itself, whether that's, you know, literally providing a space for people to network, to being a, you know, a location where you can have charity events that benefit, you know, great causes. And then the second thing, which is much more important, is the membership. You know, every great golf club has successful and a diverse array of experience within their membership that they can, again, bring to bear to benefit those in the community around them. And so that, when we kind of thought about that, we realized that we could do something a bit different. And so the mission is, you know, broadly stated, to bring people together through golf. And what that means for us is creating a community of members that's a bit more inclusive than you might see. So when I say inclusive, I'm not just talking about women or folks of color. I'm talking about beginners or families, really kind of expanding the tent around that. And then the other component, of course, is then taking those members in the course and putting them to good use for programs that, you know, programs that support or celebrate groups that are generally underrepresented or underserved in the game. So that's kind of the idea behind it.
You know, most people wouldn't think of founding a private club as a way to have an impact on the world, right? In fact, a lot of people might consider that idea somewhat off-putting, right? or sure. Almost ridiculous. Like, a private golf club, really? This is the way that you're going to do it? So why do you think of it that way?
So I think it does kind of, I think those two components that private golf clubs have that public golf courses don't are really powerful. You know, the idea that a public golf course doesn't have basically the dedicated membership that that we can kind of lean on. So like in our process, basically as part of our membership process, you know, we say, hey, we're trying to create this exceptional golf experience and we're trying to offer it at a reasonable price. But in return, we're asking you to commit to participation. And so we're getting that buy-in from members in a way that it would be much tougher to do when you're dealing with the broader public. Now, I will also say that those critics or those skeptics are entirely correct in their skepticism, right? The idea of an inclusive private club is oxymoronic. It doesn't make any sense. But our thought was, well, golf does a lot of great things, or can do a lot of great things. And this is one idea that we felt really comfortable with. You know, and then, you know, from like a, you know, nuts and bolts perspective, the idea of a private club, you know, we're not, again, it's not cheap at all, but with initiation and dues being significantly below what the market would bear, you know, it's not like we're not making money, right? But I will say that does like extinguish some of the risk. So knowing that we could raise, you know, I think we've raised $5 million through initiation fees so far with 330 members, maybe a little bit more than 5 million. That is a fraction of what it costs to build a golf club, let alone to operate it moving forward. But, you know, just from a, you know, you can't do a whole lot of good with a golf course or a golf club that isn't functioning. And so the idea of that helping us diminish the risk at the, you know, the front of the process is an important part too.
You've kind of addressed why the private golf club idea was more powerful or appealing than a public golf course. But I wonder if you could maybe talk a bit more about why you didn't choose to build a public golf course. Did you ever think of going that route as you were making this decision?
Sure, we did. And I think where we kind of fell short in moving in that direction, I guess, you know, so I live in Charleston, South Carolina, and like a lot of other cities in the Southeast, you can't get on a wait list for the private clubs around here. And even if you want to go to the Charleston Muni, you know, you got to get up early 2 weeks in advance. You know, it's like, it's tough to get a tee time, and there's not a lot of great affordable public options around here. And so when we thought about that, we thought, okay, well, maybe we could create a public course in the area that would serve everybody, and, you know, we could keep it cheap. But then you realize that, you know, if you're going to buy 200 plus acres near a city center that's within driving distance, I mean, I think there's a golf club going up outside of Charleston now. And they paid $11.5 million for, I think, 450 acres. That's a lot of money. And again, that puts you in the hole immediately, and it puts a lot of pressure on, okay, now we got to turn a profit. So that $60, greens fee that you're kind of hoping to stay at or under, like, you're like, oh, well, maybe we have to make it 75 or 80. And then the compromises begin. And so then we thought about, well, what if we did like a par three course? And again, some of that became, there's not so much of an economy of scale around developing 18 holes or 36 holes. Like, you'd think that there would be, but there really aren't. But I will say that the juice wasn't worth the squeeze in terms of the amount of effort and infrastructure you have to build for any golf facility for it to be kind of effective. And to do that, I think it just couldn't have had the same impact, I think, that we can have. So the idea of doing a private club where you've got members that can come from all over the country, you know, this national membership model is popular for a lot of reasons, but for us, it was ideal because, again, we have people that we can provide this experience, that are bought in on this mission, that are willing to pay, again, a not insignificant amount of money, but they're not going to be there every day. And it allows us to kind of build a club that is efficient. Like, right now, we have a very small team. We'll continue to grow as we add the clubhouse and the lodge, which is, both of which are under construction. But we're also, as a result of the kind of the path that we took, we can now invest more heavily and more quickly in our kids course, which will have, you know, public access certain days of the week, and will help programming for our mission. You know, it allows us to think about building a third course down the line, maybe more soon, sooner than we had anticipated, which, again, we can provide up public access or do charity events or things like that. So it's a very complicated thing, but in our mind, we try to keep it as simple as possible. And we realized that we could get a bigger bang for our buck if we took the route of a private club that wasn't, you know, 25 minutes from Charleston or 30 minutes from Charlotte or Atlanta, but kind of in a great place that was maybe in the middle of nowhere, but 2 hours to everywhere sort of thing. And that's what, you know, it turned out to be. I mean, if we had found the land in Central Georgia, we would have bought it, but it happened to be in Aiken, South Carolina, which was a great, great thing.
If you're imagining where Old Barnwell might be 10 or 20 years from now, in terms of fulfilling its mission or having some kind of impact on the community or the world, what exactly would the club be doing? What would the programming be? And what would be the kind of mechanisms of making change or kind of having a positive impact in the world? What would those mechanisms be?
Sure. So I think that I kind of look at it in two ways. The first way is within our own programming, the outcomes that we're trying to drive. And so we've been open, you know, our 18 holes have been open for 9 months now, or almost 9 months. And so, for example, our partnership with the Evans Scholars Foundation, which is a youth caddy organization, you know, I was thinking that we might have 10 or 12 caddies when we opened. We now have 100 plus caddies. We have 120 who have, you know, gotten three or more loops. That's produced, you know, 1,500 loops overall, and probably 200 grand in the like local economy of kids, you know, like when you talk about like, you know, how much it costs to take a loop plus, you know, tips and then some of those opportunities. So like we measure our programming in those ways. And in 5 years, I would like to have not only a large group of caddies, but a group of caddies that are really good at what they do. And we've provided their ample training and we're giving them the right connections to our members. And the same is true with our partnership with, you know, Voorhees, which is a local HBCU, with the Annika Foundation and our aspiring female pros. So in each of those cases, without going into a ton of detail about them, we have these grand plans, right? But really, we want to start small. And in 5-10 years, if those relationships work out well, then we'd like to expand those programs a little bit by little bit, and maybe even add different, you know, mission partners along the way. You know, and I think, frankly, we've learned a lot in some of the relationships that we've tried to build that haven't worked. And so that next 5 to 10 years will be really important as we make sure that, again, you know, get the most bang for our buck and really kind of make an impact. But more broadly, in 5 or 10 years, what I would love to see is other clubs in the Southeast, for example, where there's not really a culture of youth caddies. They see this and they realize that not only is this a service for their members, but it's a service for the kids in their community. And it can be done, you know, by partnering with Evan Scholars. It can be done in a way that's really hands off. Like they do everything. They do all the work. Or if we can have a program that supports 4 aspiring female pros each year in Aiken, South Carolina, like you can make one work in Jacksonville. You can make one work in Scottsdale. Like, so that is all that to say, it'd be really, really great if what we've been able to do and learn from our mistakes and, you know, if we can transfer those to other clubs that are interested in doing the same things, because nothing that we're doing is a new idea. Nothing. They all come from other places. A lot of these, you know, a lot of clubs are already doing these things. We just have the benefit of, we're like a laboratory. We can build it from the ground up and hopefully we can kind of, again, provide some sort of framework to export it to other clubs that are interested in doing some of the same things.
Yeah. I mean, in building the club, you're being unusually explicit and intentional about what your goals are with it. And it seems like you might have recognized early in your life that golf clubs are kind of these incredible concentrations of power on the one hand, mm-hmm. like yeah. power and money. Successful people often belong to golf clubs and they're all in that same place. And presumably that can be harnessed in some way. They're also passionate about what they're doing there, right? Golfers are passionate and they spend a lot of time with this activity at this club. And it appears to me, and I wonder if you see it this way, that you're just trying to capture some of that energy and power and push it to some ends that you yourself are passionate about.
100%. Like, you know, I'm active. I'm on the board of the First Tee here in Charleston. And what I love about the First Tee is that it's basically like a Trojan horse for youth development. I mean, yes, golf is like the idea behind it, but really it's not so much about golf for the participants. And I think the same is true for some of the things that we're doing. Like our caddies, many of them have never set foot on a golf course before, and they probably won't end up playing much golf, but they're getting to meet members who can really, it sounds cliche or maybe sounds overblown, but like, I think it's really true. Like they can change the trajectory of an individual's life. And the same is true with some of our other mission partners. And so I think that selfishly, like I'm having the absolute time of my life doing this, and I love golf and I love what it can provide. And so there's that component. Like we are not Mother Teresa doing something for the goodness of others out of the goodness of our hearts. We're having so much fun and we get to be a part of something. Like who wouldn't want to work with Brian Schneider and Blake Conant and see the drawings they come up with and walk land with them. But yeah, I mean, I think that this is a great way to harness, again, what I think every great golf club has and just putting it to good use. And again, I think a lot of, when I started this process, I think I came into it really of the opinion, and I think incorrectly, that all these golf clubs are like so traditional and it's all this and that. And like, they have no interest in, you know, doing a lot of the things that, you know, we talk about doing. And then as you get to know people within the industry, you realize that some of the most traditional, you know, the places that people think of as the stodgy, you know, backwaters of, you know, 1920s, you know, excess, like they're doing some of the most impressive work. I mean, I think like Augusta National, I think is a great example of that. You know, they've got their own history and I think they recognize that and they have done more in the last 25 years than I really think than any other golf organization to truly grow the game. Like when you talk about drive, chip and putt, when you talk about the women's amateur, to say nothing of, they don't ask for credit, but the amount of money that they invest in the community in Augusta, whether that's with United Way, or other organizations, it's absolutely incredible. And they're not asking for any credit on those things. Like, you know, we talk about the patch, which is a really exciting thing that they're doing. But there's so much beyond the surface. And so, and to me, you know, shame on me. I think coming into this, I would have thought that they were, you know, a lot of what's wrong with private golf. And now I realize that they are probably they're the best example of what golf can do to make an impact on a community.
The patch project that you just referred to, by the way, is for Augusta Municipal Golf Course, where Augusta National is partnering with the First Tee and a local community college, I believe, to
Augusta Tech. Yep.
Yeah, Augusta Tech, right. To renovate the patch, and they've hired Tom Fazio and Bo Welling to carry out that work. That's certainly a story that we'll be following in Fried Egg. But in any case, I want to get into a bit more of the nuts and bolts of sure. building this club. Now that we've kind of talked about it on a high level, philosophical kind of way, let's get into how this actually happened, how you pulled it off, right? Or how you're continuing to pull it off, because it's obviously
a long way to go. Right.
What came first, hiring an architect or finding the piece of land?
They happened simultaneously. And so I started looking online. So I have, you know, I still subscribe to this map application, mobile app, where you can, I mean, it's pretty simple stuff. I'm sure a lot of real estate agents have this, but I could see parcels, the size of the parcels, the soil types with some degree of accuracy, the topography, all of that stuff. And so, you know, without really saying anything to Sarah, as we were kind of talking about these things, I couldn't help myself. Like, I started to look at land. And then at the same time, she said, okay, well, what would be the first step? And I said, identifying a good piece of property. And then I realized to do that, you know, I can look online as long as I want, but really I needed somebody like Brian and Blake, Brian Schneider and Blake Conan, to actually be the judges of what was good land. And sure enough, you know, so I met with them and it was very informal. We did not have any contract. It was handshakes. Brian happens to live on Daniel Island here in Charleston. And so we met, and you know, they said, sure, we'll come and look at properties with you and, you know, take it from there. And I think from their perspective, it was probably a good business development tactic, even though, and I think I told this pretty early on, like they were who I wanted anyway, like, you know, having read some of Brian's essays, having listened to him and Blake talk to you and Andy, you know, it was clear to me that they were at the top of the list for me. So basically, after that conversation, if I found a piece of property that I thought was good, I would go visit it. If I thought it was good enough to warrant, you know, telling them about it, I would. And then they would come down and, you know, I joke around about this, but like they would come down and they'd tell me why I was an idiot. And I would go back to looking for a new piece of property. And over time, I kind of learned what it was that they were looking for that goes beyond just like sandy soil and, you know, land movement. It's more than that. And so, you know, it took about, I would guess, 18 months to find the piece of property that we did. And I remember Brian came down and it was not a great, the shape of the parcel originally was not great. It was originally 444 acres. And it would have been tough to route because it kind of came together at a couple pinch points. And Brian, you know, as we're walking around, he says, I don't care, get it. We'll figure it out. And sure enough, you know, they almost immediately started routing golf holes on land that we didn't own. And so we kind of had to go from there. But yeah, it really started with both kind of looking for land and hiring Brian and Blake.
Why Brian and Blake? At the time, they didn't have any original regulation 18-hole designs to their name, well, correct? And so, well, you know, a lot of developers might see this as a risk. Obviously, I knew that they were a great choice. You know, people who are really into golf architecture knew that these guys should be at the top of any list. But why was it that you went with them and were willing to kind of take what many people would interpret as a risk with them?
So again, because we're in this really unique and fortunate position, we could take the long approach. We were not talking internally, like my wife and I, about like a short-term profitable business plan. We were talking about something a little bit different. And so to me, you know, there's obviously a ton of value in the name associated with, you know, like back in the day, I mean, you know, having grown up when like the Tom Fazio real estate development was like such a big, I mean, that's how you make money, right? You sell real estate connected to a brand name. But I think that we didn't want that. We wanted a really fun and interesting golf course. And I, you know, I've told Brian and Blake this, but originally, so my idea was that I wanted to build 36 holes. And the first course I wanted Brian and the second course I wanted Blake. But it turns out that I reached out to Blake via Golf Club Atlas before I had met Brian. And then the first thing he said was, oh, well, if you're in Charleston, you should meet Brian. So I was like, okay, perfect. And then they, you know, having worked together at Hollywood and Lanark and other places, you know, I give them a ton of credit. They asked if they could work together on it. And so, and I, you know, so that was for the first course. And then Brian is the one, Brian and Blake, but Brian, you know, came to me and said, hey, before we get to the next 18, what about doing a kids course? And I was like, well, what's a kids course? And so he told me all about that. And, you know, how they have these places in Scotland that are truly for the kids. So like, at some point it became clear that Brian and Blake were not just hired for the first one. They were going to do everything on the property. And I think that what began is just, you know, me being a, how would I say, a very amateur, you know, golf course architecture nerd, and having read the books and listened to the interviews, like their philosophy just seemed to jive. And plus, I think the biggest thing for me was I just wanted to create something that was unique. And if you look at the greens that, you know, Brian's, you know, famous for, those are really unique greens. And then when, you know, Blake on your podcast talked about, I mean, he talked about a lot of things, but the sense of place, and, you know, if we wanted to be a good steward within the community, then we better be of the community. And so, you know, to have those kind of philosophies come together was really like, it was perfect. And so to me, I didn't worry about the long-term value because I knew that there was going to be a market of nerds like, you know, you and me that would love to see a course by Brian and Blake. And the rest of the world would figure it out sooner or later if they did what I thought they would be able to do, which is, has been gratefully very, very true.
All right, let's take a quick break here to talk about USGA memberships. For more than 125 years, the USGA has been working to ensure that golf has a strong future. And for almost 50 years, USGA members have given back to the game they love by supporting programs and initiatives that affect every aspect of the game, including junior golf, environmental sustainability, the history of the game, and some of the biggest championships in the sport. On top of making a difference to the future of golf, USGA members also get a number of great benefits, including a US Open or US Women's Open member hat, a personalized member bag tag, a subscription to USGA's Golf Journal, and much more. You too can give back to golf and get back some awesome benefits by visiting usga.org/friedegg and becoming a USGA member today. You know, involving Brian and Blake in the site selection process was a very smart decision and also an unusual one, maybe, in golf development. Maybe it's less unusual now, but usually when architects come into a project, the piece of land is selected and they just kind of work with it. And it sounds like Brian and or Blake went with you to view a few different sites and were able to tell you one that you might have thought was really looking good actually wasn't suitable for what you wanted to do. So I'm curious about what you learned in that process. Were there any kind of big surprises or revelations that came up for you when you were looking at a piece of land and you thought it looked great, but Brian came over and said, actually, that doesn't work for reasons X, Y, and Z? What did you learn in that process?
I learned a lot. I think, and my guess is, I've only worked with Brian and Blake, so I'm sure that it's different in each case. And right. And my guess is that, you know, they're in a unique position given the work that they continue to do with Renaissance Golf Design on their own and alongside Tom Doak, that, you know, they've seen some really good sites and they've also worked on sites that are not great, but they're not in a position where they feel like they need to, you know, they were very honest about what was good and what wasn't. They weren't like angling for the job in a way that I think some, understandably, as somebody who comes from sales, like, I get it. Like, if I want a job, like, I'm going to tell, yeah, this land looks great. Let's do it. But the first piece of property that I brought them down to, I had spent like 4 or 5 days on my own just walking around. And it was a big, it was like 500 acres. It had a lake at the bottom. There were some swampy areas and wetlands that we probably wouldn't have, you know, couldn't have touched. But there was some land movement. It was very sandy. And when they visited, they actually showed up maybe 3 hours before I showed up that day. And by the time I was walking towards them, they were walking up and like, you could tell, like they were just shaking their heads like, yeah, you know, And I think the way they described it was they could build a good golf course there, but they couldn't build a great one. And their rationale was a few things. One, so some of it was like just completely logistical, common sense stuff that I wasn't thinking of. One, you know, that property owned 80% of the shoreline of that, you know, 15-acre lake at the bottom of the property, but it didn't own the other 20%. And that's an issue. Two, the land, though there was some good land movement and probably 60 to 75 feet of elevation change, it was almost all in one direction going down to that lake. And it doesn't matter if you've got 5 feet or 100 feet, for playing to go up and down and, you know, the way that they would want to route it, they needed something more than that, something more diverse than that. The other thing is, which I thought was really surprising, but, you know, in Blake in particular, given his fine art background, they think of golf courses in this like narrative sense. And so they wanted different environments to work within throughout the course. And so what ended up happening at Old Barnwell is we've got, you know, a bunch of holes that kind of play in and around a central valley with no trees. And then a few holes that wind through, mature pines. And then a couple of holes that are on the edge of the property that are almost in, and I guess we've lost a little bit of the original look, but like prairie. And so, you know, that's not the only thing that dictates the narrative of the routing for them, but it's part of it. And so that was that first property where they kind of walked me through all that stuff was really enlightening. The other thing I will say is that one of the reasons I thought that property was really good is because there were very few trees. And so I could see the land movement. They can see the land movement when it's covered in trees. You know, it's not just looking at the topo maps, because those are pretty accurate, but they're not always accurate. But more than that, like they can really, like the valley, there's a 65-foot drop in the valley at Old Barnwell where we did end up building the course. And that was covered in like 10 to 12-year-old pines. So not tall pines, but it was covered. And it looked, I would have guessed it was like a 20 or 25-foot valley. And it was huge. And they knew that. And they saw I remember the second time we were on property, Brian and Blake took me probably about 25 yards from the first tee and said, looking out into the trees, like, this is going to be your clubhouse. Like, this is where you're going to see everything. And sure enough, I mean, it's probably 150 feet away from where that, you know, porch is going to be. It's just incredible. So they just have the ability the vision that I just don't have. So that's another component, is understanding that no matter what I see, they see something different.
So aside from that view from the clubhouse position on the current piece of land, mm-hmm. and aside from the narrative consideration of there are different sections of this property that a routing can explore, what to them was good about the site that you ended up choosing?
So, you know, there's certainly some sand. And I think Brian's talked about this. You know, when you look at Sand Valley, like that's sandy soil. Aiken's got, you know, a lot of sandy soil, but it's also got clay. And so they, in seeing the different pieces of property, you know, we can do soil testing and all that stuff, but you can get a pretty good sense of, okay, this is really sandy here and this part isn't so sandy, but can we work around this? Or like, you know, so they take those things into consideration, certainly. I think certainly the size of the parcel is really important. And so, you know, I was looking at anything over 400 yards or 400 acres. And again, that original parcel was 440 some acres. And, you know, they were pretty explicit that like, this is great, get it, but also you're going to need more. And so we were traipsing through land that we weren't buying. You know, we were reaching out to neighbors and asking if we could just take a look. And that also is really interesting because, you know, they're thinking about the 18 holes, certainly, but they're also thinking much farther down the line in terms of infrastructure, in terms of, you know, where does a parking lot go? You know, what does the entrance road look like? You know, here in Charleston, we joke around that like Yeaman's Hall is a good example of this. Like the longer the entrance and the smaller the sign outside, the better the club is going to be. And I'm not joking. So like the front, I don't know, 100 acres, maybe not 100, maybe 75 acres of our property that fronts Andrew Circle, the street that we're on, is pretty flat. And they like that. They like that you could kind of come in and then there's this big reveal. So that's unrelated to the routing. That has everything to do with the infrastructure and kind of the overall property. And again, I give them a ton of credit because I definitely was not thinking about that.
What was your role during the construction process?
I signed checks. I mean, I really, you know, early on, so Morgan Purvis, who is on our team, was the first person that I hired, and he's a jack of all trades. He's been our membership director, our partnership director. I mean, he's done a whole bunch of things, but really in the beginning it was just us and Brian and Blake. And we had a deal with a potential, you know, someone to take over as director of agronomy or to start as director of agronomy who had a fair amount of construction experience, somebody with a great reputation. And for some reason, it just didn't work out. And he backed out, and I, you know, no hard feelings. We kind of understood that he was a little concerned about the risk and the fact that two, you know, Tweedledee and Tweedledum were running the show. But so like really the extent of my involvement was I hired a timber company to clear some of the land. And that didn't work out so well. So like, despite giving them GPS coordinates, like they started clearing land that like is now to the right of our ninth tee that like they were not supposed to clear. And so that's a good example of like why Morgan and I should not be doing these things. And so when we did, we were introduced to, and I still don't understand how this happened, but he's now our general manager, but John Lavelle was the person that we ended up hiring as our director of agronomy. And he, you know, had helped, I mean, he was the project manager and built Congaree. He was the director of agronomy at Congaree and at Diamond Creek where he lived. And before that he was, you know, part of Tom Fazio's team that came in 2000 at Augusta National to tiger proof it. And he ended up staying there for 6 years, 7 years. So this is a guy with not only great experience, but when he like saw what we were doing with like the clearing, he's like, we got to call Green Tea in Augusta. They're great. They can do this. They'll do it at half the price, you know, like all that stuff. So basically at that point it was kind of hands off, and which is the way it should have been. I mean, I had to say yes or no to some of the, you know, when we had to line our irrigation pond, for example, and that's like a super expensive part of the process was building a, you know, it's 5 acres, it's 10 to 12 feet deep. And then we built half of it and it started to leak, you know, it was, the water level was, you know, going down substantially each day. And so we had to, okay, are we going to try to find the hole or are we just going to line it and understand that that's the best investment for long-term? And so to have somebody like John who had experience with those types of decisions, I felt much more comfortable saying, okay, let's spend more money now because I really do think that it'll save us money in the long run. And sure enough, you know, that's been the case because I haven't played much of a role in the construction side of things.
So you were pretty hands off when it came to the design of the golf course itself. Why do you think that owners or clients do get more involved in that side of things? Did you ever have like a moment during the project when you were like, you know, I kind of understand why somebody might want to be more active here, but I'm not going to do that?
Sure. I mean, I think, and I'm starting to feel it now because we're, you know, we're thinking about a third course or, you know, about the third course. And so having experienced now the first one and the building, it's like, oh, it'd be fun to do that. Or like, oh, I really like this part of, you know, the original course, but I'm not a great player and I've never been a great player. And so I think when you look at, who's the Sabonic guy, the Pescucci or I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Michael Pescucci, I think.
Yes. And I think he's like an exceptional golfer. And I think a lot of these owner developers are great golfers. And so they've earned the right to think about these things in a way that I don't. Like I really am only thinking about it in terms of a 6 or 7 handicap. And I don't know, like, I'm very much aware that I don't know enough to have an opinion that matters, I guess. Like, and now maybe I do, I have more of one. I think the hardest part is that, you know, as we grew our membership, and so we had 7 holes open for a time for preview play. We called it the upper loop. It was holes 1 through 5 and 17 and 18. And it was just, we tried to grasp a certain amount of holes so that our members could have something to play before we opened the full 18. And, you know, inevitably, and I think this is actually great, our members were really candid about their feedback. And, you know, the overwhelming response was so positive. But there are some people that say, well, you know, this green just, you know, doesn't seem the same as the other greens. And so my struggle is, as a people pleaser by nature, and also as somebody who has taken those people's money, is how do I balance their opinions with the opinions of Brian and Blake, who are the true experts and know a heck of a lot more than those members. I mean, now, even experts can be wrong. And I think like any course, we'll make adjustments over time. But I think, you know, the limited changes that we have made since that opening seven holes have been kind of a compromise between what Brian and Blake, like, they're not going to compromise on their strategy, period. Like, water management and strategy are, you cannot mess with that in terms of their vision, or at least I'm not going to. But they hear, they listen. And so they're willing to make some minor adjustments. And, you know, that's, I think that's a great way to listen to your quote unquote audience, but also to not lose sight of, like, we're hiring them for a reason. Like, you don't want me putting, you know, telling you where to put a bunker, or, you know, how wide that fairway should be. I'm not smart enough. I don't have the experience. I'm not as well traveled as, you know, Brian's, you know, Brian's been 15 times more places than I'll ever be. So
that's tricky though, isn't it? Because, like, the golf course is for the members, mm-hmm. right? Golf courses are for the players. And if they enjoy it, then they enjoy it. If they don't enjoy it, then I guess by definition, there must be something wrong with it, right? I'm not talking about Old Barnwell. I'm talking about golf courses in general, right? If the players don't like something about it, then it's almost like the customer is never wrong, except that we all know that sometimes the customer is wrong. And that often when it comes to matters of taste in golf architecture, golf architects often have the most sophisticated perspective on those things. And maybe some of those features that players don't like initially will grow on them over time and eventually become some of their favorite features. So it must be really hard to negotiate that complexity as a decision maker within a club, because on the one hand, yes, you acknowledge that the course is for the players, but on the other hand, you acknowledge that the architects probably have better ideas about golf architecture than the average player.
So we have members that are members at Marion, at Augusta National, at Chicago Golf, and they expect maybe not the finer things. So I think they're all down to earth. They're great members, but they have experienced something that is truly remarkable in their home clubs, right? And so I think what was really important for us in the early stages is to set the right expectations about what we were here to do. And I think that, you know, the benevolent dictator, you know, the ability as a sole owner to make decisions and not have to go through committee is hugely beneficial in something like this. But also, I think we benefit from the fact that, again, we are not cheap, but we are well below what we could charge. And as a result, we kind of, you know, it's like, listen, if you're not happy, like, we'd be happy to sell that membership to somebody else who's going to be more impactful for the mission. And we can charge more than we charge you, you know? So I think that it's not certainly the way that we would behave, but it's in the back of our minds. If people aren't happy with it, you know, that's okay. We understand it. It's not for everybody. I mean, I think, you know, particularly with Brian and Blake, you know, with zero direction from my perspective, other than to build something that they thought would be, you know, something they wanted to build. Like, of course I knew that it's not going to be for everybody, and it's going to be, I mean, I don't really care where people, you know, what side of the tobacco road, you know, controversy argument you're on. Like, is it great? Is it not great? I don't really care, because to me, what that course does is it makes you think. And it, you know, I love that there are people that do or don't like it, because they're actually talking about architecture in a way that they would never talk about architecture if they're just playing your ho-hum course down the street. And so to me, I think that by setting those expectations, we've appealed to a membership that was totally open to a unique set of greens or some features that might be too severe for, you know, a regular country club. I don't know. I think, and again, we're still so early in this process that there will continue to be complaints from members, and some of them will be well-founded. Like, there's a green that maybe could use a little softening, or, I mean, and the same is going to be true with our clubhouse and our lodge. Like, it's never going to be perfect, but we can always try to make it perfect or make sure our members understand that, hey, this is here for a reason.
What are the plans right now for Old Barnwell's buildings, clubhouse, lodging, all that kind of stuff?
So that's another thing. When you talk about, like, the nuts and bolts of a club, early on in this process, I went to two really nice guys that live here in Charleston, Chris Randolph and Jordan Phillips, who are part of, I think it's South Street Partners. And so they own Kiwa Island Club. They own Palmetto Bluff. They, you know, the Crossroads, which you guys recently featured, something they developed. And I went to them with like numbers very early in this process. And they almost laughed me out of the room very politely, but they're like, you need to double what your numbers are. And they were correct in a lot of ways. In some ways they were incorrect, or they didn't understand what we were trying to do. But one of the biggest differences that we had versus what they had is because they're in this different category of clubs, they need the 20,000 square foot, 25,000 square foot clubhouse. I think ours is, the footprint is like 9,000. We've got a small upstairs area that's going to be for staff. So like overall, I think it's like 11,000 square feet, which to me is still big, but it's very intimate by comparison. And I think that's okay. The only place I've ever been a member before Old Barnwell is Chichesse Creek, which again, I know you wrote about today.
Awesome place. Love that place. And it's such a cool club and collection of buildings that fit exactly with the golf course.
So you took the words out of my mouth. Sorry. It's so understated. No. You said it better than I could. It's just very understated and it serves its purpose. And it's not stark, but there's not a whole lot of frills. And so the clubhouse, you know, we're working with a great interior design group. We're working at the same building architects that designed every building on Sand Valley's property. So they have great experience and we're very excited about it, but it's not ostentatious. We want it to be, you know, again, it's of the land. And the same is true with our lodge, is one story, very much like the, at Chichesse, they've got the 12 single rooms and kind of a low slung connected to the clubhouse building. And so ours is like an L-shaped, I'm sure they wouldn't love me saying this, but it's like a motel. It's like an L-shaped motel with a lounge that connects the rooms and then two suites, family suites on the end, with an interior courtyard. You know, so the buildings to me, you know, they should be putting up siding in the next week, which is really exciting. And I think it's going to be exciting for our members to see the progress. But it's taken a while for me to transition from focus on the golf to focus on the actual infrastructure. And luckily we've got people that have been focusing on that for a lot longer. So I think it's going to be far more important to the development of the club than I initially anticipated. And so I'm glad that we're working with people who really know what they're doing.
Are there any costs that you incurred during the construction of the course or some of the initial infrastructure that really surprised you, where you were like, this is higher than I expected?
Yeah. The short answer is yeah. I mean, I was looking at the numbers earlier. So the irrigation pond, for example, you know, originally so we're not on city water. What's great is we have our own water supply underneath the land and we have the water rights. But to build an irrigation pond, we thought, well, do we want to do 2 acres or do we want to do 5? Do we want to do 10? Do we want to make it 4 feet or 12 feet deep? And what became pretty clear, again, working with somebody like John Lavelle, is that the upfront cost, you're not going to regret that upfront cost if you do it the right way the first time. And so that was way more expensive than I anticipated. I joke around that early on in the process, I, you know, asked Brian and Blake, like, hey, you know, you hear this, you know, it's $1 million a golf ball. Like, is that true? And if not, like, what are the things that you can do to keep costs lower and still create something that's really fantastic? And so they said, no, that's not true. It depends on the land and all this stuff. But they said, but, you know, to keep costs low, really, it's simple, you know, small greens and very few bunkers. And if you've been to Old Barnwell, as you have, the greens are not small and there are over 100 bunkers. So clearly, they didn't get their own memo on that. And I couldn't be happier, frankly. I think that, again, the best thing we could have done is hire people like Brian and Blake and then trust them to do what they do best. And that is a great investment. Another thing, I mean, I think drainage is something we did not spare an expense on drainage. That's way more expensive than I anticipated. You know, irrigation, even since we put in our irrigation system, the inflation and like, it's absurd to me having grown up on a place that didn't have any irrigation. You know, they hand watered the greens and that was it. Like, it just boggles my mind how expensive a good irrigation system is. But I was warned about that, so it wasn't too much of a surprise. I think that there are a lot of surprises along the way for somebody with, you know, zero experience like me. But again, having talked to a lot of people in the industry, I was at least given a fair sense of cost. In clearing land is expensive, particularly when you can't sell the timber. those are the things I would say that come to mind as more expensive than I anticipated.
The things that nobody thinks about when they think about building a golf course, clearing the land, drainage and irrigation. Yeah.
Well, and if we wanted city water, I remember talking to the Montmorency Water Department. So this is before we had John LaBelle. So like I'm reaching out to the county and I'm asking the dumbest questions. And if we wanted to connect to city water, we would have had to build, literally paid for them to build like 2.5 or 3 miles of pipe. And they're like, well, are you building houses? Because if you're building houses, maybe we can, like, it won't cost as much because we'll be, you know, there'll be more customers that are paying us for water. And I was like, wait, are you telling me that like we can use our own water? And they're like, yeah, totally. It's like, okay, we'll just stick with our own water. I think that sounds like a better idea. So there are so many things that we didn't have to experience that I'm sure every other golf developer has to go through. So we were really fortunate in a lot of ways too.
I'm sure people are curious about the kids course that you've mentioned mm-hmm. a couple of times and which is currently under construction, as well as the third course that I'm not sure how far along in the process you are with designing or constructing this one. But what can you tell me about these two future courses at Old Barnwell?
Sure. So the kids course is under construction now. I think there are 8 greens that are already roughed in. So we've set aside 25 acres. You know, if you'd asked me a month ago, I thought it was 12 holes, but Brian and Blake have since added 3 more. And the idea is, I know it's
they're sneaky.
Well, they're sneaky, but also I kind of love it. Like one of my favorite holes on the first course is the 13th. And that was originally going to be a par 3. And when they were, you know, building, they realized, you know, this is going to be better as a par 4. So we're par 73. And I think we're all the better for it. Because they just took what the land gave them. So I think the same. So but with the kids course, I can't possibly describe how much soil you dig up when you build a 5-acre pond that is 10 feet deep. We had 2 mountains and one was kind of sandy-ish and one was clay-ish. And basically we gave the clay away to a partner. But over the last like 5 months, our agronomy team has moved all that dirt to where the kids course is and then dug up more things to provide more dirt to create a grading plan that Brian, like a very loose grading plan that Brian and Blake wanted to work with. And so now there's going to be 15 holes, I think mostly par 3s, but a couple short par 4s. When I say short par 4s, like 300 or less. And I think we haven't figured out all the logistics of it, but I think like if you're an adult, like you can only bring your irons, like don't bring a driver, a 3-wood. But the goal is that on the weekends, you can't play there until 3 o'clock unless you're with a kid. And that's a pretty easy thing to stick to. Originally we thought, well, that should always be the case. But what we realized is that we have a large group of beginning golfers, whether it's spouses or kids, that we want to do programming during the week. We also want to partner with like Youth on Course and provide access via that realm. So basically on the weekends, it's going to be kid focused. And then I think that what they are going for, you should talk to Brian and Blake because I've seen these greens, but I'm still haven't seen a routing. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. We had a design contest where kids could submit their design for a hole. And some of the ideas were hilarious and fun, including one that had a Waffle House on the 18th green, which are on the green site, which was, I mean, that'd be pretty great. I don't think we can pull that off. But the one that won had ramps because in his description, he said, you know, it's nice to see if you hit a bad shot, it's still nice to see it go in the air. So there are going to be features like that. It's not going to be like a miniature golf course, but I think that there are going to be features so that kids can really enjoy it. A couple months ago, Blake texted me a Craigslist listing for an 18-foot grain silo, and it was for sale down the road. It was $1,000, and he's like, "Hey, can you get this?" And I said, "Well, what for?" And he said, "Don't worry about it. Can you get it?" And I was like, "Blake, I'm not going to get this." So we didn't get it. So I don't really know what his idea was there, but I do think that they're trying to create something that it's not a par 3 course. It is something different. And I'm as clueless about it as I think the rest of our members are, although the greens look great so far. And then the third course, we've got a preliminary routing. And I think what they want to do there is basically create 2 distinct 9-hole courses, in essence, that you can rate and slope as 118 holes. But their perspective is, you know, you got to use what the land gives you. And so there's some really subtle features, and then there's some really severe. That valley that is on the first course extends all the way into that backside of the property. We have about 185 acres. And so I think what they really are focused on is creating variety for members. And so, you know, those two distinct 9-hole routings will allow for you to play four different, I mean, golf courses in essence, when you come to Little Barmel. So I don't know how many years, you know, we're away from building that course. I would say that we've been really fortunate in a lot of ways. So it's probably sooner than we had anticipated, but who knows what their routing will do over time. It could change. It may have already changed since I last spoke with them.
So zooming out a bit, and looking at the kind of golf course construction surge that Old Barnwell is part of, there are a lot of new courses going up, not only in the Aiken area, but really across South Carolina and in many places in Florida, some places in Georgia. Really, the Southeast is experiencing a kind of mini or regionalized boom in golf construction. And so as somebody who's within that, who's part of that, why do you think this is happening? Why are there so many golf courses being built in this area right now? And specifically, so many kind of private clubs, often destination private clubs, going up in this one region at the moment?
So I think there are a few main reasons. The first of which kind of hits on, you know, you just said a destination golf course. This is still a relatively new business model of like the national private club. And so Cecchese, I think, is one great example. When it started, it didn't do so well. And so it's the second owner who's done really well with it as they lowered dues, lowered the entrance fee, and made it more kind of, they've expanded it to now, I think they have, I'm making this up, but I think it's 750 or 800 members. And so this is still a relatively new model that I think a lot of people are looking at and saying, you know, it's like, as Andy would describe, like the craft culture, you know, the craft beer culture, golf course architecture through the work that you guys do and others, like it's so much more prevalent, I think, within the golfing community that people are willing to pay a premium for a really interesting or new golf course by Gil Hans or Tom Doak. And, you know, the business model is pretty strong for the first owner in that case in a way that it hasn't been in the past. You can get into like the next component of it is, of course, you've got this, whatever, you know, like the 1% or whatever that can afford the 500 grand that some people are charging or, you know, again, that makes your like, you know, you get 10 members of that place and you've filled up our coffers that we've gotten in Old Barnwell for our initiation fees. And so the, you know, the numbers work out really well in that case. And right now, today, they can sell those memberships. Tomorrow, who knows? But the third thing I would say is that as you know, pre-COVID even, but since COVID, everybody's moving to the Southeast. And so, you know, I've been in Charleston for 9 years, but I'm from Chicago originally, and our neighbors here in Charleston, almost all of them are from the Midwest. And so what I would say is that just like here in Charleston, the same is true in Atlanta and Charlotte. There are only so many great golf courses or good golf courses. So for people that are looking for the private golf experience, they're SOL, like they can't get on a wait list. And so they're willing to drive 2 hours to Aiken to play. They're willing to drive to whatever the mountains of North Carolina and willing to pay a premium. And so I think that, again, right now, that business model is sound. I don't know how sustainable it is. I am not an expert on this stuff. The National Golf Foundation and, you know, the Golf Course Owners Association would have a much better take on this than I do. But I am skeptical of, like, if we were doing this to make money, if we were really, like, focused on profitability, we'd be doing things very differently. Ironically, I think that's what's going to allow us to have longer-term sustainability. But I don't know. I don't have a good answer for what the future holds. I mean, there's part of me that thinks that, like, and we kind of saw this a little bit during COVID, you know, the economy may go down a little bit, but the people who seem to be least affected sometimes are the ones who can afford a $500,000 initiation fee. So maybe this isn't you know, maybe this is what kind of keeps happening. I think I'll shout out Broomsedge in Rembert, South Carolina, as a really unique opportunity for private golf to be affordable and accessible to the public. I do think that there's a model there, but nobody's figured it out. I think if we were, if we took a long view and could, and I know this is some like a drum that you guys beat all the time, if we could change golfers' expectations around maintenance and course conditions, I think you could create a really great golf club at an affordable price and still provide some public access. But I think it's important to note, I'll say this and then I'll shut up, but exclusivity that people pay for with private clubs, like that word has such a negative connotation. But I also understand why people want or need that exclusivity for their golf experience, right? I mean, again, like I think about it. I don't want to go to Wild Dunes here in Charleston and pay $200 to play a 6-hour round. It's certainly cheaper than joining a club in a lot of ways. But at the same time, you know, we all kind of pay for different conveniences. And so I think the real challenge is how can we make these courses provide that exclusive environment? When I say exclusive, I mean access for those members so that they can play when they want and they can have the experience that they want, but also leave it open to public play. And so there are just a lot of creative ways. And I think we found that a lot of our members not only don't care that we're providing public play access, they're encouraging it. They really like it and they want to support it because they want to show off the place that they've grown to like, you know, or love in some cases. So I think that, unfortunately, I would guess that at some point in the next 5 to 10 years, there's going to be some sort of reckoning with these really expensive private clubs. But I also think that there might be a solution to it. I'm not smart enough to say whether or not that's going to come to pass.
Well, you're probably better positioned to make predictions in this realm than a lot of people. I mean, I don't know. You mentioned the National Golf Foundation and the Course Owners Association earlier. And while both of those bodies do really good research that I often avail myself of, they've also been wrong in the past, right? It's sure. Really hard to identify the signs of a bubble. We've seen this in so many different ways over the past few decades in different sectors of the economy. You know, it's almost part of the definition of a bubble that you don't know that you're in it.
Yeah.
But there are definitely some people who are looking at this development surge and saying, how can this possibly be sustainable? And so, you know, from your position as the developer, the founder, the owner of one of these clubs, what do you think are the characteristics that can make a club durable through these oscillations in the economy that we know are eventually coming?
So for us, I think, you know, like lodging, I think lodging is one for these national clubs where that is an experience that people are willing to pay for. And in our case, we are looking at kind of the market comp and trying to be 20 to 25% cheaper than that. We will still make a healthy profit on lodging at that rate. And so I think that there is that. That's something that those clubs, that all clubs can kind of lean back on for the national model. I think that food and beverage maybe plays an underrated component in this too. And this is somebody who I've been a waiter and a dishwasher and all that stuff and worked in service before, but I think that that's an underrated component around community. And so, you know, I had the chance to go to Wade Hampton a couple of years ago because the father-in-law of one of our members hosted us. And that's as nice gets in terms of the experience. And I have no idea what an initiation fee costs there. But one thing that I'll say that they did exceptionally well, one, they have great staff, but they have like these community events that are all based around dinner or lunch or whatever. And so like, it becomes part of that fabric for the people that live in that area. And to me, the more you can do that, the more you can create that kind of programming, I think that's really healthy, not just for the golf club's economics, but also for, it creates that stickiness. Now, I come from software. So like I'm constantly thinking about retention rates. Like, how do we make sure that we keep people in? I also think that, you know, when push comes to shove, a really great golf experience at a reasonable price is going to be the last membership you drop. I could very well be wrong on that. And I think everybody's motivation is different, but I feel pretty good that at the price point that we're at, it'd be, I'm not going to say foolish, but like if you had to choose between one that is, you know, equally far away or tough to get to and costs five times as much. And the golf course is as good as, you know, why wouldn't you keep the one that's a little bit more affordable and maybe a little bit more family friendly? Or, you know, like, again, that's my inherent bias, but those are the thoughts that come to mind, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, there's something about the older model of the American private club, the local club, that maybe has been lost a little bit, perhaps because a lot of these clubs struggled during the recession or even before that. But local clubs in a lot of places are or used to be general local institutions. It's where you'd go to get married. It's where you'd go to have a nice meal. It's where you'd go for a bridge night or something like that. You know, there would be all sorts of events happening at the local club. It was the local club. That's what you went and did that. And there were members who would play golf and stuff like that, but it was generally fairly open to the community. And it seems like some of that has been lost in the past few decades and would seem to be recoverable, you know?
I would think so. And I think it, and I know that the park has its own, they raised however much money in 2 months to get the park going, but
right. And, like, and West Palm Beach, the municipal facility there. And
but that could be a central hub. And the same thing is true at Winter Park. So like, I think that there are places that do it really well. And I know that Chichester, for example, they are very profitable in terms of food and beverage because they do it right. It's nothing fancy. It's just really good food done right. It's not uber expensive. And so it's a place that you want to go to. And so like, I live 2 hours away. I'd rarely stay overnight, but like, I kind of want to, you know, like I'd prefer to stay overnight because it's such a great experience, you know? So I'll say that one of the things that I've seen in this environment. So there are a couple of clubs in South Carolina. So like Orangeburg Country Club is about an hour and 10 minutes from downtown Charleston. It's probably an hour and a half from Charlotte. It is a great older course, you know, a little rough around the edges, but totally affordable. It is a community club. They're seeing an uptick in members coming that are from Charleston that can't get off a wait list, that are willing to drive an hour and 15 minutes. Camden is a great course. Same thing. And so I think that the many kind of the whack-a-mole of all of this development and exclusivity may benefit some of those community clubs in a way that is kind of, you know, one of the unintended consequences. My concern is more about, you know, the clubs on the North Shore of Chicago where I grew up caddying. A lot of those clubs before COVID couldn't pay younger members to join. There just wasn't, and I don't know if it was generational, but, and then COVID hit and then everybody wants to join and they start, they raise their rates, they pay down their debt, and then they immediately go back into debt because they're now investing in these new, you know, whatever is new and shiny. And that is a recipe for disaster, I think. I say that with such, you know, lack of knowledge about, you know, their vision. And I'm sure we'll get to that point too, where we make stupid mistakes about what we spend money on. But like we have a treehouse. We spent a lot of money on building a treehouse. And I remember talking to my father about that. And he's like, you are insane. Like that is the dumbest money you could have spent. And I will say that at least as it relates to our mission, I actually feel like the return on investment with that will be pretty easy to kind of measure because my son, Henry, who's six, really not into golf yet. This is going to be the most miserable thing ever if my kids don't like golf. But when that treehouse was built, he was like, let's go to Old Barnwell. And so we went there. We spent an hour and a half on it. And then at the end of it, he's like, can we go hit balls? I was like, we don't have a driving range yet, but yeah, we can hit into the dirt. I'm like, great. Like it got him to play a little bit of golf. So maybe there are things that clubs, like we stumbled upon that idea, but like maybe there are things that clubs can do where, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's golf adjacent or golf related, and it's not a huge investment, but it will bring, again, that stickiness to their membership.
All right, Nick, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Really enjoyed this conversation and best of luck with Old Barnwell.
Thank you. Thanks for putting up with my yapping. I enjoyed it.
This episode of the Fried Egg Golf Podcast was produced by Matt Ruscius. Thank you, Matt. If you'd like to do something really quick that helps us a lot, go to wherever you're listening to this podcast and give us a rating and review. We read all the feedback that we get and we like hearing it from people. So if you do that, it will help us find new listeners and it'll also give us good information about what we're doing well and what we could do better. Thank you for listening to this episode. We'll be back again soon with another.